Well, good morning, everybody. Welcome to this Tuesday broadcast for the Roundtable and of the Roundtable panel. We certainly welcome you and are very thankful that you are with us on this Tuesday morning, the 29th of April, 15 minutes past 9 o'clock. For those of you keeping score at home, we have a wonderful panel, and we will introduce them in just a moment. Quick reminder that tomorrow we're going to be broadcasting from the Hartwick College in Oneonta tomorrow, beginning at 9. We'll be going from 9 to 10:30 from there, and then we'll have, obviously, the rest of the show from here. And, yes, we'll be at two places at one time. And we're going to have a really vibrant, great discussion tomorrow, and we're looking forward to it immensely. And that will be happening tomorrow. All right, let me introduce the group to you. Malia DeMontis here, Chief of Staff and Vice President for Strategy and Policy at Bard College. Good morning, Malia. How are you?
Good morning. Today is a special day for me in a way. This is my 100th appearance on the Roundtable.
Oh my goodness. You keep track?
Well, a little while ago I was like, I've been on the show for a while. I wonder how many. And I did. I counted it up, and today is 100.
Well, congratulations.
So it's a better 100 than the other 100 that is happening.
Yeah. Yes, that is very, very true. Well, congratulations. It seems like only yesterday, doesn't it?
It does. So my first appearance was the day before Biden's inauguration. And I don't know if...
Wow.
Yeah. We were all broadcasting from our homes, right? I had never been here to the studio. I didn't know what any of you looked like. And I was sitting by myself in my study in the middle of COVID. And you asked me, is there going to, because this was just a couple weeks after January 6th, Malia, is the inauguration, welcome to the Roundtable, is the inauguration going to be disrupted by protesters tomorrow? And I explained why I thought it wouldn't be, and thankfully I was right.
You're
so
right.
You've welcomed me back.
Yes. Yeah, because if you had blown that one, you never would have come back.
Yeah.
Well, that's great. Congratulations. That's very exciting.
Well, thank you for having me.
Yeah, well, it's wonderful to have you. Good Lord, Mike, how many times have you been on?
I don't know. You know, longevity. Maybe.
Mike has been with us since the beginning of the show. And
how many years is that, Joe?
Well, you know, we're getting up to a big anniversary. And I just think it's fascinating that I'm very glad, because long ago we didn't have a panel. We had we did a thing called... what do we call it?
Talk to the editor? I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. It was the editor corner. And each morning we would call up. It was basically our poll question of the day. And then what would happen is we would do headlines from a local newspaper editor. Every day we would have a different paper. And, that's back when they had newspapers.
Multiple, yes.
And then...
They still have them, Joe.
It would be a smaller list.
That was back when people read them.
Yes. And then Mike would come on, and then we would do a poll question of the day. And, what do you make of tariffs or whatever, and what are your 100 days? And then people would call up. And but then we went to the panel format, and so... But Mike was, predates that. So wonderful.
Well, I'm happy to be here.
All right. Well, I hope that by the next time you come, you will have counted up all your appearances.
Don't count on that.
Yeah, no, exactly. Yeah, like I don't know how many I've been, but whatever. Mike Spain is a dear friend, our stalwart here, and former Times Union Associate Editor, and thankfully has been with us for a very long time, and we're... We won the lottery on that one, so thank you very much.
Thank you,
Michael. Jim Hendler, you're no slouch either. You've been here for quite a while, but do you remember what year you started?
No, but I do know that every month when I get the thing from Sarah, I breathe asking for next month's dates. I breathe a sigh of relief that you're still inviting me back. So that's how secure I've been about this since the very beginning.
Well, I mean, yeah.
It was before COVID. I think it was may have been during the first Trump administration.
It's been a while. I know it's been a while. Well, it's great. We have a wonderful group of panelists, and it's always changing. And we have our old the favorites that we've had for a long time and new people, and it's all very exciting. So thank you, Jim Henler, for being with us. Tetherless World Professor of Computer, Web, and Cognitive Sciences at RPI. Okay. Let's get started with the news of the day, and so we'll talk about the new Justice Department mission. Apparently, it's not justice anymore. No, this story came out midday yesterday, late afternoon, where hundreds of lawyers and other staff members are leaving the Justice Department's Civil Rights Division as veterans of the office say they have been driven out by Trump administration officials who want to drop its traditional work in order to aggressively pursue cases against the Ivy League, other schools, and liberal cities. The wave of departures has only accelerated in recent days as the administration reopened its deferred resignation program, which would allow employees to resign but continue to be paid for a period of time. The offer for those who work in the division expires on Monday. More than 100 lawyers are expected to take it on top of a raft of earlier departures in what would amount to a decimation of the ranks of a crucial part of the United States Justice Department. Now over 100 attorneys decided that they'd rather not do what their job requires them to do, and I think that's fine, said Harmeet Dhillon, the new head of the division, in an interview with the conservative commentator Glenn Beck, who I swear as I read this was, wow, he's still around?
Yeah.
And over the weekend welcoming the turnover and making plain the division's priorities. We don't want people in the federal government who feel like it's their pet project to persecute police departments, she said. The job here is to enforce the federal civil rights laws, not woke ideology. Traditionally, the department has protected the Constitution and the rights of minority communities and marginalized people, often by monitoring police departments for civil rights violations and protecting the right to vote and fighting housing discriminations. Now, more than a dozen current and former Civil Rights Division lawyers say the new administration is intent on not simply modifying the direction of the work, as has been typical during changeovers from a Democratic administration to a Republican administration. The administration is instead determined, the lawyers say, to fundamentally end how the story division has functioned since it was established during the Eisenhower administration in the 1950s. Jim Henler. You were gasping the most,
yeah,
so I thought I would go to you first.
I mean, this is just, you know, this was always the last bastion of civil rights. This was, and you know, I grew up sort of on the civil rights movement and then the Vietnam movement, so I've sort of been around a while of these things where some place, you know, and we've seen this happen year after year after year, you know, some violence or something breaks out, the police come in, or there's some young kid who's shot for some reason, and we always hear about, you know, as well as the civil charges or as well as the local charges, there are federal charges. This is the group whose job it was to say the Constitution has these amendments that offer equal protection to everybody in the United States. And now we're saying, well, we offer equal protection to everybody as long as they're on our side, agree completely with us. I just find it scary. I mean, these are and you know, hypocrisy, lack of empathy. I mean, every story now just makes it worse and worse. It's like, I don't know, you know, I had a lot of friends who were sort of, let me call them progressive pessimists, right? I was always sort of, you know, I would have once upon a time called myself, you know, center left or mid-left, and now it's like, you know, I'm listening to these people who I used to think were paranoid, And what's happening is worse. And there really is no entity in the government that can put a halt on this, because it's the Justice Department itself that had the job of making sure that a government agency like this wouldn't have done that. So it's really strange. And then, you know, talking hypocrisy, it's like, you know, gee, all these guys who used to hit policemen with flagpoles on January 6th got pardoned, but now we're going to make sure that any policeman who harasses a citizen doesn't get charged with a federal crime. I mean, I don't even know how to go as dark as it needs to go. And it's almost every story is the executive power being amplified by people around the president who are willing to do things and then force capitulation from folks who really, you know, don't believe it, but need the need the government. You know, I mean, one of the large companies I work with just yesterday or a couple days ago announced it was giving up its DEI policy. Now I have to decide, you know, what am I going to do? You know, I personally do not want to be associated with them, but my university, they're a major partner and that sort of thing. I mean, we're forced into these dilemmas just day after day after day because of this lack of any kind of balance. We have a constitution that was designed to have a sort of a three-legged stool, as we used to, you know, learn about back when they had civic classes and
or Schoolhouse Rock.
Yeah. And, you know, when Trump was elected, I said, well, at least we have the judiciary, other than a few problems with the Supreme Court. Her answer was, yeah, but what happens if they just don't do what they say? And I said, nonsense. I don't say nonsense anymore.
Malia.
Sorry.
So it's very, of course, very sobering. And I think you used the word scary, Jim. And so
you could have stopped at 99.
Yeah. So there are a couple of things I want to comment. One is, the Department of Justice is not the only government, federal government agency that has an office devoted to civil rights. And so there are a number of ways that the federal government is supposed to or has intended to or Congress has directed it to investigate and prosecute civil rights complaints. And the Department of Education is another federal agency that has an Office of Civil Rights. The headline now is about the largest one, which is rightfully housed within the Department of Justice. But we've seen these other offices across federal government also be neutered or have, in a variety of ways, through people leaving, firing people, changing the writ in some, or stopping resources to that particular office. And just to go further with the Department of Education example, there were already, I'm more familiar with that one because I work in higher education. There were already well-established processes by which anyone could submit some kind of complaint to be investigated through the Office of Civil Rights and the Department of Education. And those processes have worked for many years. And then the Trump administration invited that office to become more focused on a particular issue, which is anti-DEI, by setting up this website, which is basically an invitation to trolls to submit whatever they want, and without evidence, just a short narrative of a complaint about any school anywhere engaging in what anyone might think is diversity, equity, and inclusion activities. The administration is in some cases sort of directing the public into ways to help politicize these departments by setting up websites like the one in the Department of Education I just mentioned, and in other ways, just wholesale redirecting the the office itself, like what we're seeing now with the Department of Justice Civil Rights Division. So what does this division normally do? As far as I understand, a lot of its cases are things that are far from the headlines. It's housing discrimination and employment discrimination. How is that huge chunk of work going to be affected by this? I know that the Trump administration really like enjoys these headlines and probably gets a lot of support from their base for putting things like this out into the public. How much will it disrupt the core work of the division, which is to continue prosecuting and investigating the serious problems, the systemic problems that still exist around this country, and more mundane, let's call it, issues of discrimination that haven't risen to the same kind of political level.
Well, and also, I'm sorry, Mike, I didn't feel.
Oh,
but the level of, I don't even know what word to say. I mean, you know, I don't want to call it evil, but it's close. So, for example, there's a 988 suicide hotline. It was set up nationally so that anybody considering suicide, particularly youth, could immediately reach someone, connect with someone. They were actually funded so that in some cases these people could follow up and stay with the. And a large part of that was LGBTQ youth who are, I forget, it's four times as likely to commit suicide, 10 times as likely to consider it. So the administration has decided to cut the funding to that part of 988. I mean, it's like, gee, why don't we just let all these kids go commit suicide? What's wrong with that? Deporting a four-year-old with cancer, even though they were a U.S. citizen because they happened to show up somewhere with their mother, and the father's like, wait a minute, I'm a citizen. You know, you're supposed to talk to me. I mean, it's just blatant disregard for not just the law, but for humanity. Sorry. I was really upset today.
Mike Spain.
Yeah, part of this too, and you guys articulated it very well. I mean, it's you know, pretty much pulling the rug out from under these efforts that have been part and parcel to the way the Department of Justice, the Department of Education, and other agencies have served the public and what their mission has been. But when you read that more than 100 attorneys who were professionally dedicated to protecting civil rights and monitoring the proper administration of everywhere through society how civil rights are protected, it's like so many things that are part of what's going on now. These guys are going, men and women are going, and it's not going to be, you know, another president can be elected in 2028 who can say, we're going to bring all this back. You're not going to bring it back. This is going to take a long time to recover from this. It's like our trade policies. You know, if somebody else steps into the White House, if Trump were to, you know, get decide to resign and you know, move to Saudi Arabia tomorrow, and someone comes in and says, we're going to fix all this, you can't fix it. These things are being broken. They are deliberately being, just taken apart. And it's going to be very, very difficult in this case and in so many other cases to restore and go back. It's not going to happen. And our allies know that whatever happens with the next presidency, 4 years later, you get another Trump-like person who will undo it. So we're really long-term badly impacted by this.
I think that's an interesting point as to how long it takes back to turn. I mean, not just this issue, but everything across the board. So much has been done in 100 days. And to get us, if we want to go there, and I don't know. I mean, obviously, this is up to the people to decide as to where they want to go. But it's interesting on, you know, what can be done, and then ultimately, does it ever go back again, and to a at very least a respect for the Constitution and a respect for the institutions of government, right? I mean, that seems to be the hard part.
I think there's a little bit of an analogy. I think of like an old, glorious, but still healthy tree, but maybe it has a branch or two that are slightly diseased or whatever. But instead of pruning those branches or whatever, you just decide to hack the tree, the whole tree down. And not cleanly either. Just, you know, hack it a little bit here and a little bit on the other side, and it's just a complete mess. And that's what I feel like is happening to our government. So even if, you know, you plant a new tree to replace the old one, it's going to be a sapling for many years before it can really grow back to the size that the previous tree was. So it's not a perfect analogy, but that's kind of what I think of. And, you know, having served in government, when we went through we went through sequestration, which those of us who are in government are very familiar with. It's still not a well-known term outside of government, but it was sort of a mini version of what we see now. Sequestration was when the government, basically Congress, mandated some budget cuts, and the federal agencies weren't really given the latitude to decide how to take those cuts. It's like, you got to cut 20% everywhere. And so with that kind of indiscriminate cuts, it really, like, it ended up costing money in the long run, because not everything is equally important or equally resourced. And just to take that sort of thoughtless approach and think, we cut 20%, so we save 20%. The math doesn't add up.
Well, you use two words that do not seem to be in this equation at all. And that is, and I was going to say thoughtful approach.
Oh, okay.
I mean, where is a thoughtful approach in any aspect of anything that is being done? And another way of saying, what's the plan? What's the end game? What are we trying for? And I think both Republicans and Democrats, conservatives and liberals, will look at this and say, I mean, we see this in the latest polling. The two words they're using to describe it, at over 60%, scary and chaotic.
Yep. But intentionally. I mean, I don't think...
Oh, yes.
I don't think there's any... I mean, the plan, if there's a plan, is to break these longstanding institutions, deliberately break them, just, you know, take them apart. That's what the Secretary of Education is doing. She's tearing apart and closing the Department of Education. That's the plan. That's her charge. And you see that all across government. And this is just another plan to get rid of this component, this whole area of enforcement of civil rights. And it's regarded as something that has weaponized, you know, the opponents of this kind of effort say that the government is weaponized and the Department of Justice is weaponized going after people for violations of civil rights. And this is going to just make that very, very, very difficult to rebuild after Trump is out of the White House.
You know, the other aspect of that rebuilding. So I'm a fellow of the National Academy of Public Administration. And for a long time, a lot of what we've been focused on, as well as we do reports for the government to help with various issues, but a lot of it has been, how do we get people to want to serve in the government and in public administration, right? It's not where you're going to go to get rich. It's not where you're going to go, particularly, you know, I've been involved in technology, cyber, those kind of things, and trying to explain people why being part of a functioning civil society can really be important and worthwhile work when you could make more if you go work for some large company. Many of our seminars now are more on how to transition out of the government safely and what are the ramifications if you take one of these buyouts. And, you know, it's like our panels have changed from how to get people into the government to help them find a safe way out. And we still want to get more people in. We still believe in the importance of public service. But it's hard, you know, how do you convince someone who wants to get into public service to help people well, when they're reading these kind of, hearing these kind of stories.
This fall, I'm going to co-teach for the second time a course at Bard called All Politics is Local. And so trying to help students understand the impact, the importance of village, town, county, state government. And this course became a lot more popular during and since the pandemic when people really got a better understanding of how important those local levels of government are. So I hope that, and I see that a lot of people are still interested in public service, but they see a lot of opportunities in other places. And so that's where I've always encouraged students to think that way. A lot of young people are drawn to go to Washington, D.C. to work for federal government. And I usually advise them, you know, don't try to go to D.C. immediately, even before this administration. You know, you're going to be a tiny cog in a huge, huge wheel. Get some experience overseas or, or go see what local government is like. You'll have a lot more responsibility and you'll learn a lot more portfolios before going into federal government. So I see that young people are still interested in that. So I don't think that there's a move away from interest in public service. In fact, a lot of people are feeling newly called to it because they see that in some cases, like here in New York, we've got these shield laws. We see the tension between state government and federal government, and a lot of people are in favor of that and want to support what some of the New York state agencies are doing. So. To me, there is some positive movement or some glimmers of hope here where young people are continuing to choose public service.
Well, I look forward to tomorrow, and we'll talk to some young people who have already made that choice and are going in that direction and hearing from them. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. We'll return right after this. Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Very nice to have you with us on this Tuesday morning. I do want to remind you that you can be a part of the conversation. All you have to do is write to us, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. Ellen says, seems to me the current playbook was long devised by Stephen Miller to suffocate in stages, the means to eradicate all avenues, is to sustain the well-established and long-held systems which sustain American democracy. One piece after another carefully being destroyed, revolution may be the only way to halt this.
Suffocate in stages. That really speaks to me because I think that explains why so many of us feel like we're drowning.
Right. And then that idea that the only thing in this listener's mind that can change it is revolution.
Yeah, I mean, that's a drastic way of looking at it, and what is the way to come back on this? I suppose you should take some solace in the 100-day polls. You know, after the first 100 days of Trump's administration, it's clear that a lot of Americans have second thoughts about the way that the election turned out last fall, to put it mildly, and they're not supporting the policies that are that we're talking about so much every day here, and you know, it just takes time to undo when something has been destroyed, like so many things have been destroyed already and disrupted and torn apart.
That first line of the article. And they talk about the shifting focus of the Justice Department. They want to drop the traditional work in order to aggressively pursue cases against the Ivy League, other schools, and liberal cities. Hmm. And I find that interesting because it – and correct me if I'm wrong on this, but I didn't hear a whole lot of talk of this during the election – like as far as we're going to dismantle these cities. We're going to take this, we're going to change all these things and do it in this way. In fact, Doge wasn't even a part.
I think MAGA supporters expected it to happen, though.
Yes.
There was the playbook. Yeah. You know, Project 2025.
Well, but this has even exceeded 25. That's the amazing thing to me. I mean, I looked
which
at
they distanced themselves from in the campaign, of course.
Well, but by saying that it was, quote, too conservative, unquote, or too, you know, it was seen as too much.
Quaint.
Too radical. No, and yet what they've done is almost everything they've done is to the right of what was recommended in
this was a plan. This was definitely a plan. And Stephen Miller is frequently one of the ones that have been identified as one of the, you know, the, I guess, the co-writers of that type plan. But it was the intention all along. And I agree with you, Joe. I mean, I don't think a lot of this was articulated, and people did not realize what it would be. Now, there were promises to, you know, deport millions of immigrants, and people seemed okay with that. Now, suddenly, they're looking at what's going on, and they're saying, ooh, that's not okay. You know, as Jim was pointing out, you know, taking a four-year-old American citizen who's suffering from cancer and just deporting that child without any arrangement to have medical care on the other end, wherever the child was sent, et cetera, to Honduras, and to follow through with that. I mean, that's just one example of stories we're hearing about every single day. And it's ghastly. I hope that the writer of that note is wrong, that it won't take a revolution, but it's going to take a firm response, which you're beginning to see start to bubble up, but maybe it's already a little late.
Yeah, you know, I have been looking at, you know, there's a zillion small protests. We've had a couple bigger ones, but I'm remembering the things that were relatively effective, maybe not instantly, but over time. The March on Washington,
Civil Rights
later
marches.
On the Million Man March, Earth Days. I mean, times where we had 200,000, 300,000 people on the mall. And it doesn't seem to me it'd be hard to do that now. It's just that I don't think a specific leadership has come out yet. I think there's some emerging. There's a lot of organizations. I think if they can pull together, I know this was discussed a little bit yesterday where there was a lot of discussion of, quote, the resistance, unquote, but it's not an organized resistance. I'm not talking now about a military resistance. I don't think the U.S. could easily have a civil war right now. It would be
too many different we're having things one. Owned in,
well, no, I mean –
culturally.
Yeah, cultural war, certainly. But that's very different than, you know, people in one state certainly. Dropping bombs on people in another state and, you know, a military coup, et cetera. But – I do think that, you know, you haven't seen the Martin Luther King. You haven't seen the Gandhi. You haven't seen the person who's going to really or people who are really going to say, look, you know, this is what's going on. And if we want to do this. So I think it's a revolution, but I don't think it's revolution in the sense of a lot of us out there with pitchforks and shotguns. I think it's really convincing the Congress, convincing the politicians, convincing the body politic, as it were, that this is not okay.
Let's go to some letters, and we have quite a few, and I'd like to get to as many as possible before the top of the hour break. We go to Sherry. It looks like you guys have finally realized how serious things are. Better late than never. Oh, Sherry.
I was going to say, I think I remember day after the inauguration we were saying this.
I did, you know, you just can't see us with our head in the oven on the radio. But thank you. I'm glad it's coming through now. Destruction of the American government system is the longtime ideological goal of Steve Bannon and Stephen Miller.
Read it all on Bannon's War Room website. They are living their dream. That from Ed. Then we go to Jeff. It's interesting that one of the few carryovers from the first Trump administration is Stephen Miller. It seems that he is responsible for the most cruel and racist aspects of this administration. Whenever he appears on the media, he spits bile. He talks in condescending, narcissistic manner. A good, deep, psychological, journalistic profile of him would be most welcome. Isn't he Jewish and had relatives who were lost in the Holocaust? Is he truly as evil as he appears to be? We'll let that question fester.
The common denominator among these, you know, the people that are behind this, and Trump fully falls into this category, is the complete inability to have any empathy. And it is it's a psychological disorder. I mean, they're incapable of being empathetic for the pain and suffering of others.
Barbara. Musk came out with that explicitly. He called empathy a weakness. He called empathy the problem with our government. And that just blew my mind. Anyway.
Barbara, meanwhile, says, please discuss the lack or abdication by Congress of their responsibilities, especially the Republicans.
AWOL. They are out there doing nothing. But there was a story this week about Michael Lawler, a congressman from the lower Hudson Valley, Rockland County, and in New City, the base of Rockland County, he had a public event, and they just shouted him down for 2 hours. And he's a moderate Republican who's thinking about running for governor of New York and regarded as a middle-of-the-road Republican, and he's hearing it. I mean, these people are they're really not doing anything. They're just watching the Trump administration do this with very little criticism, you know, a few veiled criticisms from Republicans, and that's it.
For Republican lawmakers, it would indicate that they're doing exactly what Trump wants to do. I mean, they're facilitating what is going on.
By being quiet,
yes, but they're not. Yes. I mean, but then you assume they are supporting that. Like you,
absolutely.
Because if you didn't, hopefully you would actually open your mouth.
Yeah. Very few something. Republicans are openly criticizing what Trump is doing.
Yep. And they see, you know, they've seen in the past what happens to those who do, and especially with this retribution-based government.
The one that's kind of amusing to me is Senator John Kennedy from Mississippi, I believe.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, he's got a couple of things.
Where's Mississippi?
Right.
Mississippi?
I believe.
I'll look it up.
Or Louisiana. Please, I apologize if I got that wrong. But John Kennedy's been actually politely criticizing Trump over a few things. And that's maybe the beginning of because he's a, you know, a dedicated supporter.
I was at an event
Louisiana.
Yeah, Louisiana. Okay, go ahead.
I was at an event in Kingston on Sunday, and both congressmen who represent parts of Ulster County were there, Congressman Pat Ryan and Congressman Riley, and they talked about trying to focus on kitchen table issues, such as trying to make things more affordable and really meet people where they are. I mean, I think Josh Riley's district adjoins Representative Lawler's district.
Yeah.
Yeah, and these are places where they're, in some cases, where Trump won the district, but then they elected a Democratic congressperson and both of these men appear to continue to have the support of their constituencies. And I think that's because they are trying to focus on what they call the kitchen table issues. So if they feel like Congress is less effective right now, to put it mildly, than the American people might want generally, they're finding those ways where they can bring bipartisan people together. And Josh Riley mentioned some bill that he's introducing to lower egg prices, for example. So this may feel like, in the context of what we're talking about, constitutional threats, egg prices, well, you got to you got to meet people where they are and try to help with their daily lives. And if that's where some congressional representatives can be effective right now, that's where they're going to try to be effective.
I also think it's very telling, as we're talking about anecdotes about the first 100 days of the administration, but I do think it was very telling about 3 weeks ago when Trump said, I'm sick of hearing about egg prices.
Wasn't he the one that brought it up during the campaign?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, of course.
Yeah.
But he was also going to solve the Ukrainian situation day one. Now he's saying, hey, if Putin and Zelensky aren't going to agree, I'm just going to walk away.
Well, that was the issue before. They weren't agreeing.
Yeah.
Actions by the current administration are being done with no regard because there is none, writes John. They don't care about polling or any other ramifications as they do not plan on giving up power. For sure, part of the playbook as well. Then we go to Susan. Are we going to have a situation where citizens begin reporting institutions and other entities for DEI and
yes.
other Trump?
Yes, I believe that already happened
yes.
a couple weeks ago.
Yeah. As well as neighbor reporting neighbor for some infraction, where will it end? I mean, well, this started, I mean, well, it started obviously long ago, but I mean, we saw it even after the abortion decision and that part of it of you know, pointing out providers and people who were going for services. I mean, it's yeah, and now it's just,
well, and
it's out there.
The other thing we see is almost, I want to call it the setting up of traps. Okay, so the woman who was deported with the two young kids.
Which one?
I was going to say the one yesterday or 2 days ago.
The mother with two American.
The mother with the four-year-old cancer victim.
Two American-born children.
But was reporting to a mandated, you know, was allowed to be in the country as long as they came every couple months to such and such a, I forget what it's called. You know, basically say, hey, I'm still,
basically,
it's basically, I'm still here.
ICE.
I haven't broken any laws. Yeah. My kids are still, you know, American citizens. But now the question is, okay, so now if you don't go to that, you've broken a law, which means you can be deported. If you do go to that, they're grabbing you and deporting you. I mean, it's, you're seeing literally, you know, these things set up in such a way that you're forcing people into the kind of thing you were just saying, Joe, of, you know, sort of you're complying with the law and you get in trouble. So you start breaking the law, you get in trouble. And then you start with people saying, well, you know, my neighbor is not doing what they're supposed to or things like that. It just escalates.
Well, the uplift will continue in our second hour of the roundtable, and we welcome you to join us. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We will commence after these messages and news with Ray Graham. Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable and to the panel discussion. And we have a great group this morning. Malia Dumont, Chief of Staff and Vice President for Strategy and Policy at Bard College. We also welcome Jim Hendler, Tetherless World Professor of Computer, Web, and Cognitive Sciences at RPI. And Mike Spain, former Times Union Associate Editor, is here as well. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. I want to read a couple of letters regarding the last conversation we had, we were having, which started off in talking about the exodus from the State Department and became a broader conversation about just these jobs and what is being held and how things are changing. Lisa writes to us and says, yes, keep reminding the public that Stephen Miller is responsible for much of Trump's agenda. And yes, they suffer from narcissistic personality disorder. Trump is just a figurehead and not smart enough to realize that he is being used by the Heritage Group, Project 2025, et cetera, et cetera. Then, Susan, are we going to have a situation where, okay, we did that one and I apologize. Kate says, folks, make no mistake, this is a backdoor eugenics program. The administration doesn't give a rat's patootie over waste,
fraud, or abuse. Cut the funding to programs that help the poor, the sick, the disabled, minority groups, etc., to make the country safe for rich white people, i.e., dudes. Then we go to Frank. DEI is illegal discrimination, and the DOJ is going to go after all illegal discrimination, even the discrimination you agree with. Civil rights are most important and for the groups you think shouldn't get them, and right now that means even straight white males can't be discriminated against. By the way, I love the show, and I listen every day. Well, thank you, Frank. We appreciate that add-on to your thoughts. We also go to Bill. I don't believe the term moderate applies to Congressman Waller like John Faso while he portrays himself in that way. The reality is that he is a political opportunist, someone who gauges the whims of the party's leaders and either follows along or remains mum. I'm not defending Mike Waller on this, but isn't that sort of what politicians do? Like, I mean, that's sort of part of the job, right?
I was going to say, like, one of the reasons that Congress is not accomplishing much right now. I don't think that the majority of Republicans or Congress are actually MAGA Republicans. What's happening is they're being enabled by folks like Lawler, who maybe I don't know much about him, but maybe he did come in with more of a moderate background, but now he's going along with it. And so if whether you truly believe in what's happening or you're just going along with it, the effect is the same.
It's exactly right. And so many pieces have been written about journalists who've had off-the-record conversations with multiple members of Congress, Republicans, who say they are absolutely appalled by what's going on. But they rationalize being quiet. Because if I open my mouth, Donald Trump and Elon Musk are going to throw millions and millions of dollars against some right-wing wackadoodle opponent who will challenge me in a primary, and I'm going to lose, and then that person might get elected, and that'll be terrible for my constituents. Or worse, a Democrat might get elected, and that would be terrible for my constituents. So in order to protect my constituents and then represent them properly, I have to go along with Trump.
Well, and, the other thing that I
tortured,
think—
by the way.
Yeah. The other thing that I think a lot of the Congress people are saying quietly is Trump is ignoring laws that were passed by Congress. Trump is overturning agencies that he's not allowed to touch because they were congressional agencies, and they just don't care. So I think there's a lot of people in that middle group who are just saying, under Biden, we created these bipartisan things. We did things like ARRA and stuff like that.
Or long before Biden.
Long before Biden.
But I'm saying, but coming out of Trump won, right, they moved into a stance partly because there were more Democrats, partly because of who the people were, where there was willing to be some negotiation. And you had a smaller MAGA group that didn't control every vote. Now you sort of have the people who would like to try to reestablish some congressional rights, whether they're, from the Democrats or from the Republicans. They just don't see a path. And, I think either we the people have to show them the path, or somebody has to start standing up and saying, look, if four of us go like this, right, that can change things. But that's just not what we're seeing. And it also gives you a deadlock situation, because the only thing that can go through without a filibuster is certain budgetary things.
And judicial nominations.
And judicial nominations.
And the Supreme Court.
Yeah. And the current budgetary negotiations are not reaching agreement anywhere, Congress or the Senate. So that's another problem. Well, I'd be very surprised if we don't end up in another continuing resolution.
The clock in the wall tells me it's time to talk about Canada.
So let's do that.
You have a Canadian tang under?
We go from Vancouver to Montreal. That's the 4 clocks on the wall. It's amazing, actually. So we now know the outcome of the Canadian election. It was interesting. I was watching this last night as the votes were coming in, and I was trying to wait to send out a final article that sort of said this is the winner. But and then I think the minute I gave up is when it came through. But anyway, Mark Carney and the Liberals win Canada's election. The former central banker successfully convinced voters that he was the right candidate to confront President Trump's trade war and threats to annex the country. Carney led his Liberal Party to a narrow victory in Canada's pivotal election on Monday, securing a fourth term in power for the party and a renewed mandate to lead the fight against President Trump over trade and the nation's sovereignty. Mr. Carney, a former central banker who was running for office for the first time, struck a combative tone toward the United States during his acceptance speech in the early hours of Tuesday at a Liberal Party event in Ottawa. It was unclear whether the Liberals would win a majority of seats in the next House of Commons, which would allow Mr. Carney to govern relatively unimpeded, or if his government would need to rely on smaller parties to support his legislative agenda. Mr. Carney has not met Mr. Trump in person since becoming Liberal Party leader and Prime Minister last month, but he made Mr. Trump's menacing comments about making Canada the 51st state and the tariffs he has imposed on Canadian goods the center of his campaign. The two men held what they described as a professional call before the election, though Mr. Carney said during the campaign that Mr. Trump had brought up the 51st state threat during that conversation. Mr. Carney has said that he will maintain Canada's retaliatory tariffs against the United States, but he has cautioned that expanding them would harm Canadians more than they would pressure Americans. Mr. Carney has also pledged to diversify Canada's alliances and trading relationships, and he made a brief but important trip to Europe to underscore that latest approach. In his acceptance speech, Mr. Carney stressed that his priority would be to continue to push back against Mr. Trump. Quote, "As I've been warning for months, America wants our land, our resources, our water, our country," he said. "President Trump is trying to break us so he can own us. That will never happen."
The stories that have been coming out of Canada for several months, I think, reflect the results of yesterday's elections in Canada. And you know, time and again, they'll go up to people on the street and they'll say, you know, what do you think about what's going on with the U.S. and U.S. President Trump, and, you know, talking about annexing Canada, making it the 51st state, and the 25% tariffs against Canadian goods coming in the U.S., et cetera. And they feel completely, you know, I guess the term is they're feeling, why us? What did we do? They're feeling like their best friend just turned their back on them, and it's causing them you know, great pain, and they anticipate and they're digging in, and it's been reflected in. Just one anecdote was that airlines are noticing a major decline in the number of tourists flying into the U.S. from Canada as a destination. And the trip Carney took to Europe, even though it was more symbolic going over and kind of shaking hands, you got to wonder in this environment. And I wonder, Malia, you're all things international. I mean, do you think there's any possibility that we could be forcing Canada into some kind of, you know, quasi-membership to the European Union economically? I mean, that would really hurt the United States economy.
Well, I think certainly that. Thank you for asking. that's a direction. Canada feels sort of estranged from the United States.
Betrayed.
And so they look like, okay, if the United States is not our friend the way we thought or it should be, then where are our friends? And so it makes perfect logical sense. And Mark Carney strikes me as someone who seems logical. He's got a background in finance himself. And so, you know, why not explore that? It's one of the, I think, most surprising effects so far of the Trump presidency is this sense of Canadian nationalism that maybe was below the surface before, but it didn't seem to be something that a lot of Canadians would spend a lot of time thinking about, is Canadian national identity or wanting to sort of proclaim it proudly in contrast to, you know, what the United States is. And it's seeing that manifest is really interesting. And I think one of the ways it's going to manifest is in Canadians and their new leader trying to, like, really establish on the international stage, not just in their own political discussions internally, but on the international stage, how is Canada different from the United States? And not wanting to sort of be lumped in, which I think it often has been, including in the minds of a lot of Europeans. They think of a North American bloc, and that still exists in a lot of ways. I mean, the we still do have a joint military command that we run with Canadians, but in a social and political sense, I think this is the beginning of a trend of Canada. It has long socially and politically been much closer to Europe anyway.
Right? Well, and
it's just geographically hasn't. Obviously.
Well, and then I think the other thing is economically, because as the U.S. becomes a less friendly trading partner, we've always been their biggest. Now, suddenly, Europe is where they're going to have to go to sell some things or buy things. In other words, if the U.S. is going to really maintain a lot of these tariffs, then that pushes Canada to make deals with other countries that don't.
But logistically speaking,
So
one of the reasons that's true is because obviously we have this humongous land border and it's easy to ship goods across it. So there are infrastructure barriers to Canada. I mean, they can't.
Right.
Obviously can't replace the United States as a trading partner. And Vancouver has a lot of ports. And so we're talking about Europe right now, but Canada is also a Pacific nation.
That's true.
And so I think in some ways they're better already established to increase their trade with Asia. There isn't a city in the Canadian Maritimes that's as big or has the infrastructure to support a hugely increased trade with Europe.
Yeah, but the personal sense of betrayal that's expressed, and if the Canadian population feels that way and they do turn to other trade partners, a new person in Washington who wants to undo that, they're not going to just warmly run back in. It's going to be a long-term, if not permanent, change in the connection that we've had for decades and decades and decades with our Canadian neighbors.
Yeah, and I think betrayal is the right word to describe what I'm hearing from my Canadian friends. One of my closest friends, I've mentioned him on the program before, lives in Toronto, and we text almost every day, and usually in English, sometimes in Chinese. And a couple weeks ago, he just randomly started. We met in China. Started texting me in French, which I like French too, and I went along with it, and we're texting back. So I finally asked him in French. I said, "Is communicating only in French, is this a form of protest against the American government? Like what?" And he wrote back, and he's sort of joking, but not really. He says, "Not everything is about you," and I think that's what a lot of that's sort of expressing that Canadian feeling now. There's a sense of betrayal. This sense of, I think, possibility with the new directions that they're going to explore, and it's not all about the United States. Canada's a great nation. It's got a lot going for it.
Absolutely, and I know it's not, that whole thing about it's not about the United States, and yet
wouldn't have happened without.
Well, it seems to be a surprise that countries are fighting back and saying, "No, we're not going to do that. No, no. I mean, in some cases, obviously, there's interests that they have to protect. But by the same token, they're standing up and saying, I don't think so.
Yeah.
And okay. I mean, to me, that makes perfect sense. What I don't understand is why we didn't, like, see that coming.
Well, but also why – I mean, the trade deal we have with Mexico and Canada – was negotiated by the Trump administration, the previous Trump administration. They took the earlier NAFTA.
The USMC. The
USMC.
It was,
they made it more,
yeah,
a little bit more American friendly, shall we say, but US friendly. But the sun turning on Canada was just, I mean, I.
Well, that's one thing Donald Trump has done. It has united Canada.
Yeah.
You know, Canada has its factions, too. And the West, you know, is more conservative, you know, out where the, you know, the oil fields are. And in the, in of course, Quebec, to our immediate neighbor to the north from New York, you know, there's people who came very close to breaking away from Canada not that long ago. And, you know, there are these factions, but it seems to be that Donald Trump has succeeded in uniting a country, but it's Canada.
And how quickly that happened.
Amazing.
Also, so the guy who had been projected to win wasn't even reelected to his own seat.
No, right. That's right. He lost his seat in the parliament. And the I read a fun anecdote about Mark Carney. He does, like most Canadian politicians, they learn to speak some French well. And they're judged in Quebec by how well they speak French. And he does not speak French that well, but they still really like him. And they joke about his French pronunciation. And they accept it because they have embraced him because he's standing up to Trump.
Well, you know, the other thing is I sort of approve of the idea of making Canada the 51st state because I looked at their voting patterns, and if they had been the 51st
state,
it would be Kamala, not Trump, who was our president.
I mean, and you just look at how it started of, I mean, calling Trudeau Governor Trudeau.
Out of nowhere.
And, I mean, it's just it didn't start good, and it certainly wasn't going to end well. And here we are.
And you know,
we'll see where we go.
Mark Whitman made a good point when he was on early on after this all began with Canada. He said Trump was using the excuse that fentanyl was coming into the U.S. over the Canadian border. He said that the experts have estimated you could fit the fentanyl that came into the U.S. from Canada into somebody's backpack or purse. I mean, it's a minuscule amount. That was a phony way to impose a 25% tariff on our next-door neighbor.
Well, and, you know, I was reading New Yorker had a great article in one of the past couple issues on the Mexican president who had come in as a follower of the previous government, which was quite what we would call conservative, or it wasn't quite populist MAGA, but it was on the way there. But she has become a very pragmatic politician because of the same thing, the Trump administration trying to bash on Mexico. So now you have, you know, what used to be, again, at least a trading bloc, if not everything else. And so borders are getting harder to cross. I know a lot of Canadians who won't come to the United States because they're under the same rules as anyone else coming into the United States. They can have their phones taken away and checked. They can have, you know, be held in, I'm sorry, we don't think your documents are quite right. We're going to hold you for a long time while we check them. I have a friend whose son went to school in Canada, is working in Canada. They still go back and forth, but they're very worried because his Canadian visa moving towards citizenship, right, it makes it so that they're going to visit him. They're not having him come visit them because they're simply afraid that the U.S. will suddenly say, sorry, you're a Canadian cheating on something or other. And, you know, I'm sorry. It's insane. That word keeps coming up in my mind today. I wish I could come up with something more professorial.
Let's go to a couple of letters we've gotten, some on other topics. And we go to, you'll like this one, Mike. Mike Spain is completely correct about Republicans. I have a friend in New York State Assembly who is a Republican and fears losing his seat, so he keeps his mouth shut because he believes he is a moderate and believes that his voice is important in the dynamic of our legislature. In reality, he ought to speak up and not worry about losing his seat. I've told him his integrity is far more important than his tiny grip on power. Then we got this letter from Larry, who says the opinion offered that a civil war was not likely overlooked several things. One is that it would not be war between the states. It's already a war of the federal government against the states. Ask the governors of Maine and California how things are going. Ask the governors of Arkansas, West Virginia, etc., how their request for federal disaster aid is going. Second, there is more than one way to have a civil war. Look at Lebanon and Syria and Argentina and everywhere else the rule of law breaks down. Look at the heavily armed militias out there. The January 6th rioters freed by Trump. Do you really need to ask where violence could come from?
So I was just to be clear, I'm scared to death of the violence aspect. I'm scared that as a resistance grows, then so will the anti-resistance. And, you know, that's exactly the crowd that was the January 6th crowd and things like that. But I'm talking about, you know, civil war in the sense of, like, you know, the civil war we had
that battle early between on. The states, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you know, sort of we do have red states and blue states, and you could imagine some kind of conflict. But we also have a federal system that would make it very different, you know, sort of. Again, so I think the kind of civil war they're talking about does scare me. I, you know, don't know if we're in a place where that's too likely. But I just meant an organized civil war of the kind where, you know, a bunch of states secede and the federal government says, okay, you can't secede. We're going to, you know, do whatever. I mean, that just doesn't, knock wood, doesn't seem to be in the cards, although there are times where I wish New York would succeed.
In the cards is we have to take a break right
away. We could be a good part of Canada.
We'll be back right after this short break. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. We welcome you to join us, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org, and we would love to hear from you this morning. So we're going to move on and go to other stories in the news. And again, we'll certainly welcome letters on the other topics as well, but we are going to move on as our time starts to dwindle here. The question about leaks within the White House and Washington, and this is something that certainly came up during the first Trump administration of a crackdown on the leaks. I think all administrations have had to deal with this at one time or another in some way. So here's a cool new trick. National security agencies across the Trump administration are ramping up investigations into alleged leaks to the news media, in some cases using polygraph tests that current and former officials say are creating a climate of fear and intimidation. At FBI Director Kash Patel's direction, the Bureau in recent weeks has begun administering polygraph tests to identify the source of information leaks. An FBI spokesperson says, the new use of polygraphs at the bureaus, which are commonly known as lie detector tests, has not been previously reported. The seriousness of the specific leaks in question precipitated the polygraphs as they involve potential damage to security protocols at the bureau, according to the spokesperson, who declined to elaborate. However, just adding to this Washington Post story, you will recall, of course, Department of Defense and at the Pentagon, that as that inner circle of Secretary Pete Hegseth was starting to crumble and unravel, it's much better now, that they were saying they were going to be using polygraph tests. And then some people left, but they were actually never used in that particular case, but they are being used in other cases. This ramp-up has been bolstered by Attorney General Pam Bondi's new legal guidelines that allow the Justice Department to subpoena reporters' personal communications and broaden the scope of potential criminal prosecution of leaks of not just classified material, but also, quote, privileged and other sensitive, end quote, information that the administration says is, quote, designed to sow chaos and distrust in the government. Mike Spain.
You know, you said it at the beginning, every presidential administration has been vexed by leaks to the media. You know, we go back all the way to Watergate, and we know about Deep Throat and how it exposed the inner workings of the Nixon administration and brought about his downfall eventually. And presidents hate that. And Obama was really angry about leaks out of his administration. But there has been, you know, there's shield laws in 48 of 50 states, and there's been efforts to try to get a federal shield law, which I don't think has a shot in the dark right now, to protect journalists from having their documents subpoenaed and to have their phones tapped, et cetera. You need an extraordinarily, you have to get a judge's order if you're going to do anything like that, and it has to be compelling. And the Merrick Garland has respected the rights of the press to not go after, and that was policy, to not go after their notes or their recordings or their whatever information they have. And what this is going to do is by these, you know, using polygraph and other intimidation on federal employees, it's intended to do exactly what you expect, shut down the amount of people that are willing to take the risk and feed information to the free press so that the public can actually learn about what's really happening in government, because sometimes the government doesn't want you to know. And it's courageous of these people who do make this information available to reporters. And now they can go, and now they're threatening to go after reporters and reveal it. And reporters are just going to just go underground. They're going to use all kinds of ways to hide information. They're going to plead the Fifth. They're going to plead the First Amendment. And it's just an adversarial situation that will probably curtail some flow of information. But in the end, it may end up inspiring people to get more information out. You know, that's Daniel Ellsberg was upset back in the 60s that the Pentagon was not telling the truth about what was going on in Vietnam. So he just put it all in a suitcase and handed it over to the New York Times and the Washington Post. I mean, there will be people who will do that. And to me, though, I think we've got plenty of proof about what's going on. And it keeps on flowing. So I don't think it's going to stop. It's just very intimidating and scary.
What I do find scary in this is actually what's almost added, it's added almost parenthetically, right? Broaden the scope of potential criminal prosecutions, leaks of not just classified material, but also privileged and other sensitive information that the administration says is designed to sow chaos and distrust in the government, i.e.
What is anything. Other they, sensitive?
That's anything. The point, yeah. is it's whatever they want. Now they can say, I'm sorry, that thing you just reported, even the, you know.
I want to hear their definition signal. Of chaos and distrust.
Well, I mean, you know, it's sort of like, you know,
we may find common ground there.
I was going to say, I don't know if it counts as a leak when you actually add a reporter to your signal channel, but
what's so maddening about this? So there are deliberate leaks, and then there are unintentional leaks, and like the biggest unintentional leak that's happened so far was by the Secretary of Defense, you know, and that's apparently. Yeah. You know, that's not even mentioned here in what the administration is doing. So it's clearly they are just only wanting to go after who they perceive as their political enemies. Yeah. And I think reporters are resilient. They have they're very I think there's a real sense of solidarity among a lot of members of the press, regardless of their politics, about the imperative of making sure that the public is aware of important information. This expanded sort of prosecution, litigious attitude towards the press is not going to serve the American people well, right. Although it might serve Donald Trump's politics well.
Well, and, you know, it's one thing to say, you know, the reporters are first reading things, and we've seen some examples of that. But the problem is they work for large corporations in many cases, newspapers that are being forced to bow down.
I will look at what's going on at CBS because their parent company, Paramount, wants to split up the company and sell part of it. It needs federal approval, so yeah. 60 Minutes is now evidently, according to reports, credible reports, sending the scripts of anything to do with the Trump administration to Sherry Redstone, who's one of the principals in the you know, overall company, and that forced or led to the resignation of the managing editor of 60 Minutes, which was a terrible, terrible turn of events. And Trump is suing 60 Minutes for something like $60 billion because of the way he accuses them of allegedly editing a Kamala Harris interview in a way that made it more favorable for her and didn't reveal everything she said when he refused to even be interviewed by 60 Minutes. I mean, it's preposterous. But yes, Jim, you're right. A lot of these journalists work for organizations that, on the other hand, if these organizations are not publishing this material, there's other ways for journalists and right. plenty of avenues now for them to get the word out.
But I will say that I thought the commentary by Scott Pelley, while short,
yes.
at the end of Sunday's broadcast was courageous and brilliant. It really was. It was obviously very much saying that, I mean, there was kind of a come please help us moment, you know, where they're just, you know, we're being.
I don't think anybody got that approved by Sherry Redstone ahead of time.
No, but I thought the two points that he made, one is that, you know, how shocked they were and how that this is somebody that you would, you know, you'd go to war with or for, that the whole staff and showing those pictures of everyone together and the boss that you want on your side. I thought that was one important point. And the other is that, you know, that by doing this, he ultimately has helped us because we can continue to do what we're doing. At least that's how he saw it in leaving. So I did think that was an interesting commentary.
Yeah, I think the, you know, the analogy here is look what they're trying to do to public radio and public broadcasting. This station itself is being challenged by some of these things. And, you know, whether you agree with us or not on this program, but if you want to have fairly reliable news coverage, especially news that's covering the area that we you know, the states that we broadcast into, you know, these same issues apply because a lot of that, you know, we've had to have federal
controlling
laws,
the funding, controlling the approval of mergers, you know, using polygraphs and subpoenas to get to the sources. They're all part of a mass effort to constrain the free press.
On that note, we will constrain all of us by ending. And my thanks to everybody for being with us this morning. Mike Spain, thank you very much. Always great to have you
here.
We'll see you on Thursday. Jim Handler is with we'll see you soon, I think. Is right? No?
I'm not sure yet.
All right. To be determined.
We don't know the May outcome.
That's right. Okay. Well, we look forward to having you back. And you know what? I hope this was a special 100th appearance.
Woo-hoo.
I should have brought
kazoos.
I was going to say, may your 101st be a more pleasant show.
I hope there are hundreds more, and I thank you very much for being with us. Finally, just a reminder that tomorrow we'll be at the Hartwick College Institute on Government, and we look forward to having you with us listening. Tickets are gone, but we do have the opportunity through this thing called radio, the opportunity for you to listen in and to hear the conversation that we will have at Hartwick College in Oneonta tomorrow. In the meantime, the show will continue. We'll be back right after this.